Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Alison Singer's daughter, Jody, was born in 1997, and pretty much right from the start, Alison was worried something was wrong.
She had troubles from the time she was born.
Jody wasn't eating or sleeping much. She cried constantly.
And I remember asking my mother, you know, did Stephen have these issues? And she said no. And so I said, well, at least it's not autism.
Stephen is Alison's older brother who has severe autism along with intellectual disabilities. He was diagnosed in the 1960s, the dark ages when it came to autism.
My mother was blamed for my brother's autism. Back then, we thought bad parenting was the cause of autism. My mother was told by a reputable doctor that she was too cold to properly bond with her son, and that's why he retreated into the world of autism.
Autism had only been identified as a distinct diagnosis in the 1940s, and there wasn't much help available for kids on the spectrum or their parents.
There literally was nothing. Back then, children with autism were institutionalized. There was no Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. He had no right to go to school. He was considered not able to be educated, and so why would you send him to school?
Alison's brother is nonverbal, prone to aggressive and self-injurious behaviors, and he ended up being institutionalized. So all of this was on Alison's mind when her daughter Jody showed signs of developmental issues and when the little girl was eventually diagnosed with autism. Alison feared her daughter would have the kind of life her brother had. No schooling, no relationships, no job, no real future. But Alison was determined to fight.
So when Jody was diagnosed, of course, being a crazy type A mom, I started talking to parents and I went online. The internet was pretty rudimentary back then, but I was able to find some information. And all of the parents at that time were reading a book called Let Me Hear Your Voice.
It's hard to overestimate how big of a deal Let Me Hear Your Voice was. It was published in 1993, written by Catherine Maurice. Around this time, there was an exponential rise in autism diagnoses and not a lot of resources for families. The book introduced readers to a type of therapy called ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis. It's intensive and uses rewards and consequences to change children's behavior. The idea is to reinforce, quote, good behaviors and to punish and eventually eliminate the undesirable ones. Once Catherine Maurice described how much this therapy helped her daughter, ABA became something parents in the autism community were talking about and demanding for their children. For many families, ABA was a lifeline, the one thing that seemed to help their kids. According to early advocates of ABA, it had the power to make children on the autism spectrum, quote, indistinguishable from their peers. But there was a catch. It should be delivered early in the child's development, and it needed to be intensive, to the tune of 40 hours a week. Alison made sure her daughter got ABA, and she says the results she saw in Jody were undeniable.
Oh, we saw some changes almost immediately after a few sessions, and I was like, wow, this is magic.
Jody started ABA shortly before her third birthday, and soon she learned how to sit down and pay attention. She learned how to switch tasks, something that used to be a nightmare.
So before, she would have these terrible hour-long violent tantrums if she had to transition from a preferred activity to a non-preferred activity. And over several weeks of ABA, she was taught that first she would need to do something else and then she could go back to her preferred activity.
The therapist potty trained Jody, something Alison had been struggling with for months, and that meant her daughter could now go to nursery school. Most importantly, ABA taught Jody how to communicate.
She couldn't even answer yes or no to a simple question like, do you want juice? Let alone what kind of juice does she want? So those are the kinds of things that they helped her to communicate. What are her needs? What are her wants? And helped her to communicate them to both my husband and myself so that we could meet her needs. And then once she was able to do that, a lot of the tantruming subsided because she was able to communicate.
Jody learned how to say hi, how to give her parents a hug or a kiss, how to interact with her sister.
That was just a very sweet and lovely change in her.
These are the kinds of positive changes people were hearing about. And by the early 2000s, parents across the country were pushing for access to ABA. They successfully lobbied their school districts and insurance companies to pay for it. And if that didn't work, they appealed to their representatives, even went to court to fight for coverage. As a result, ABA became widespread, the go-to approach. Now, the first generation of kids who received extensive ABA therapy has reached adulthood, and many of them have a very different take on ABA and the role it played in their lives. Far from seeing it as an effective treatment, they say it was repetitive and boring at best, and coercive or abusive at worst. On this episode, ABA and the heated debate around this therapy approach. So, how can people look at the same therapy, ABA, and have vastly different takeaways? Pulse reporter Liz Tung has been talking to people who had ABA, to parents, therapists, and autism experts for months, and she has this in-depth report.
I can't see Brian Rodenwald when we connect over Zoom, but I can hear him. He tells me he's pacing back and forth across his hotel room in Romania.
If I'm walking, then that means mentally that I've escaped a bad situation because I'm on the move and I'm free because I can move around. I'm like in fourth grade.
I'm catching Brian in the middle of a 3-week backpacking trip to Europe. He's an avid traveler. On this trip, he's already hit up England, is spending a few days in Romania, and then heading to the Netherlands. He talks for a while about Romania's public transportation. It's one of his favorite things to explore when he goes to other countries.
That's one of the positives about traveling solos. I get to form my own decisions on what to eat, where to go, and how to enjoy the area.
Freedom is a big deal to Brian, because for a lot of years, it's something he says he didn't really have, in large part thanks to the intensive ABA therapy he was put through.
What are some of the things you would do as a kid that they didn't want you to do?
Like walk around the room, and the teacher did not want me to do that because it might upset the other children or something to that effect.
Brian's 28 now, a computer programmer and software engineer who got laid off when COVID hit. But even though he's years past ABA, he says he still lives with the trauma of it every day. It's one of the reasons why he carries around his favorite comfort items wherever he goes, a stuffed octopus and stuffed cat.
Because they're with me all the time. I can talk to beings that aren't people, and they don't yell at me as much as some other people at school did.
Brian grew up in Arlington, Virginia, and he first started ABA in 1999 when he was still in pre-K and continued with it off and on for about 10 years. It was part of an initiative by his district to mainstream autistic kids, put them in regular classrooms as opposed to separate ones.
So it was seen as a very strong success story, as I was one of the first autistic people to be promoted from my elementary school to my middle school, who was doing work beyond my grade level.
The goal of ABA was to keep Brian at pace with his peers in just about every way and to modify his behavior. For instance, one of the most common lessons Brian would get over the years was about eye contact.
I got too many lessons on eye contact every year. And it was boring. Again, it was boring. And I told myself, I already knew how to do it. Why do I have to do it again and again and again?
Eye contact is tough for a lot of people with autism. To this day, Brian finds it uncomfortable, bordering on painful. Teachers would always tell him that eye contact communicated to the other person that he was listening. Though, ironically, it had the opposite effect for Brian.
I spend too much energy trying to focus on looking at the person instead of listening to the content of what they have to say.
But even more than forcing Brian to establish new behaviors like eye contact, he says ABA was about stopping certain other behaviors. One of the biggest rules, and for him the hardest to follow, was staying in his seat.
They wanted me to sit down in one seat for hours, and I can't do it, and I can't do it.
Walking around, moving his body, helps Brian feel calm and focused. It's part of a common autistic behavior called self-stimulating or stimming. It can manifest in all different ways. Hand flapping, pacing, rocking back and forth, spinning around, chewing on things, humming, muttering, repetitive speech, and sometimes in harmful behaviors, like headbanging. But for the most part, stimming is harmless and even helpful. Autistic people say it helps them self-soothe, especially when they're experiencing sensory overload or anxiety, or just as a way to communicate how they're feeling, whether it's excitement or distress. Sitting still, Brian felt like he'd jump out of his skin. But at school, his teacher and his ABA therapist told him he wasn't allowed to move around, to be himself. So to Brian, ABA felt constraining, like his every move, his every natural impulse was being judged and judged wrong. Instead, he needed to be more like his peers. And at its origin, that is what ABA was designed to do. The guy who's mostly credited as ABA's founder was a clinical psychologist named Ivar Lovaas. Although he didn't invent ABA, that would be the behaviorist B.F. Skinner, Lovaas was one of the first to apply it to autism. Back then, a lot of kids with autism were seen as lost causes. But then in the 1950s and 60s, Lovaas started using behaviorist techniques to stop autistic kids from self-injuring, and then to teach them language, eye contact, and how to respond to instructions. By the 70s and 80s, Lovaas was publishing papers showing incredible, groundbreaking results. He talked about ABA as being almost like a cure for autism, about kids recovering, gaining IQ points, and making autistic kids, quote, indistinguishable from their normal friends. And that seemed to be Lovaas's goal, which might explain why stimming was one of his pet peeves. He called it garbage behavior and thought that it prevented autistic kids from learning. Not to mention, it marked them as obviously autistic. And Lovaas would go to great lengths to stop what he considered to be undesirable behaviors. In the early days, that could mean ignoring, shouting at, slapping, or even delivering small electric shocks to kids. But there were also rewards, like juice or M&Ms. It was all based on a technique called operant conditioning, which involves reinforcing the behaviors you want and punishing the ones you don't. By the 90s and early 2000s, when Brian was in primary school, mainstream ABA had shifted. Instead of food, rewards centered around prizes, like stickers or games or letting the kids do something they liked. Punishments involved taking those things away or withholding attention. Now, in some ways, this isn't so far from how a lot of people parent their kids. Rewards for good behavior, timeouts for bad. But in Brian's case, this system ruled his life. Everything he did, from minute to minute, all day long, was judged and graded on something called a behavior sheet, a form that kept track of how his days were going in a very visible and sometimes public way.
Well, basically, I was given a tally of points.
Imagine if you received a report card for your behavior every day of your life, and that you got marked down for things you did unconsciously, twirling your hair or biting your nails, blinking or saying when you spoke. And imagine that every infraction could potentially be called out in front of the class. That is what it was like for Brian. He says from what he can remember, the sheets started in first grade, and the people who decided how many points Brian received or lost were either his teachers or his in-school ABA therapist, called his one-to-one, or as Brian called them, his minders.
What I remember the most was them telling me to stay on task. And the first time I learned about the behavior sheet, the minders told me, well, you'll lose points on it. And that was a shock to me. And some of the people there cared more about the point system than my very well-being. And oftentimes I would be told to listen to a conversation that lasted 2.5 hours or longer because I lost. The teacher gave me a frowny face for stimulating too much because I, quote unquote, was not calm.
Smiley faces or check marks meant receiving privileges or little prizes. Frowny faces meant things he liked or even depended on were taken away. One of the worst punishments Brian remembers was losing computer access, not just at school, but at home, too.
My computer had been a safe space because I was afraid to go out. And so the computer has been a bit of a oasis from the hell of schools.
Brian's parents had to sign his behavior sheets every week. He remembers one time swiping his sheet and filling it with check marks to show he'd passed his eye contact and stim suppression.
The teacher even noticed and berated me publicly here in front of the whole class.
Brian says this was the worst part, that he was singled out again and again, which wasn't just humiliating. It had the opposite effect of what the behavior sheets were supposed to do, help him focus in class.
I knew the teacher was not focused on the lesson. They were focused on trying to control me in one way or another. And that very much demoralized me.
It also ingrained something very powerfully in Brian's mind, that he and all of his natural instincts were fundamentally flawed.
I felt like something was wrong with me because the behavior sheet told me something was wrong with me.
This went on for years. And then suddenly, without warning, when Brian was in middle school, they stopped using the behavior sheets. He says there was no big announcement, no reason given as to why this was happening now.
I tried to celebrate, but I couldn't. But I couldn't because I could remember they would tell me that a behavior sheet could be reintroduced at any time.
For the most part, Brian's life got better from there on out. By high school, the worst of the ABA system was over. No more behavior sheets, no more minders, and he got to work at his own pace. In college, Brian got his first real taste of independence. One of his favorite memories is the summer he spent studying Japanese in the city of Akita. Being out of the country, far away from the people who'd policed him, he felt liberated.
None of the people who have ever given me a behavior sheet have accompanied me to any of the 24 or more countries I've been to. I've never gotten a behavior sheet, ever. And that's why I feel safe right now in Romania.
But the feeling never lasts. That, for Brian, is the legacy of ABA. No matter where he goes, he can't escape this fear that someone somewhere is going to pop out and tell him he's doing something wrong. And that feeling continues to affect Brian's life in very real ways. It's why even now, Brian feels the need to mask. That's a term used by autistic people to describe basically suppressing their autistic instincts in order to blend in with neurotypicals. It's a big part of why a lot of autistic people criticize ABA. They say it doesn't actually get rid of their need to stim or avoid eye contact. It just teaches them to do the exhausting, self-negating work of masking. Another lingering effect of ABA for Brian is complex PTSD, or CPTSD.
Needing to find the exit route from a situation compulsively is my biggest feature of CPTSD.
It's the first thing Brian thinks of when he gets to a new place, even riding trains or buses. Where's the closest exit? How can I escape? It's been more than 15 years since Brian was subject to ABA. Since then, he's managed to move beyond it in some ways, but not all.
I've learned how to navigate life without ABA, as I'm doing now. I'd rather talk about the future than the past, but the ABA has caused me to think about the past way too often, and I don't want to do that anymore, but I can't help it.
There was a lot about ABA that Brian hated from the start, but it wasn't until years later that he came to think of it as abusive. The forced eye contact and stim suppression, behavior sheets, and constant policing. It's a conclusion that a lot of autistic kids of his generation have come to over the past few years. And this backlash against ABA, it mirrors a big shift in the autistic rights movement. Just a couple decades ago, most, if not all, of the advocacy was being done by the parents of autistic kids, like the parents who fought so hard for ABA to be covered. In those days, autism was frequently thought of as a disorder that needed to be cured, or at least treated. But that's changed.
We don't need to be fixed because we're not broken. There isn't a cure, there isn't a treatment that you can get that will cure autism because we're not diseased, we're not injured, we're not at fault in any way.
This is Emma Dalmain. She's a leading autistic rights advocate and the founder of the nonprofit Autistic Inclusive Meets, an autistic-led organization based in London. Emma is both the parent of autistic children and autistic herself, something she found out in her late 30s, around the time her son was being assessed for autism. That's also when she first learned about ABA. To find out more, she reached out to autistic teens and adults who'd gone through ABA, and what she heard was not good.
You take a child who's highly vulnerable already and has a communicational difference, and you tell them that they cannot flap their hands, that they can't self-stimulate, that they can't regulate, they can't ground, they're forced to make eye contact. And you're teaching them that their autonomy is not important. As long as they comply to the adult sitting opposite them, then they get something nice. They get a treat or they get their iPad for 2 minutes, and then it gets taken away again to motivate them and reinforce the desired behavior that the therapist wishes to see. So if you think about it, what is that teaching a child? It's teaching them that their own comfort doesn't matter as long as the adult's happy.
We talked about the system of rewards and punishments, which is a big focus of criticism. And I asked Emma about one of the defenses I'd read of ABA.
Some people say that it's just sort of another version of how people parent their kids, you know, by giving them rewards when they're good or giving them punishments when they're bad. So what makes ABA different from that sort of just like general parenting framework?
ABA has a specific agenda behind it. The agenda is compliance.
With regular parenting, Emma says, you're using reinforcement to establish boundaries. But with ABA,
you're using bribery. You're using manipulation. You're using reinforcers. You're using planned ignoring. So that, I'd say, is a big difference between mainstream normal parenting, so-called normal parenting, and a compliance-driven therapy. I wouldn't even call it a therapy. I call it a training program.
And then there's one of the biggest critiques from a scientific perspective. As it turns out, despite all of founder Ivar Lovaas's exciting, groundbreaking studies, the evidence isn't as solid as everyone thought. Here is autism clinician and researcher David Mandel.
And it also turned out that some of the data that supported these, you know, revolutionary effects were fabricated. Right. So when you look at the first randomized trial that Ivar Lovaas published, where he said that half of the autistic youth who received ABA services, their teacher couldn't pick them out of a lineup, it's not really clear that those data were accurate or that was a good outcome.
There have been a few studies over the past decade that have backed up the effectiveness of ABA. But a lot of holes remain. For example, there aren't a lot of well-controlled studies that tell us what kinds of kids are good candidates for ABA, which is a major problem when you consider the huge range of disability that autism spectrum disorder covers.
That's Liz Tung reporting. When we come back, we'll hear how practitioners are responding to the criticism of ABA and how some are rethinking their approach.
What function is that behavior serving that child? And what do we need to do to help the child be more comfortable in the world?
That's still to come on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. About 1 in 44 American children has been identified with autism spectrum disorder. And we're talking about a popular therapy that's used in working with many kids on the spectrum, ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis. Many see it as a really helpful and effective approach, but in recent years, it's come under intense scrutiny as repetitive, boring, or even coercive and abusive. Reporter Liz Tung first talked to people who've had ABA to understand why this approach is facing so much backlash.
ABA has a specific agenda behind it. The agenda is compliance.
They wanted me to sit down in one seat for hours, and I can't do it, and I can't do it.
Next, Liz looked at how experts are responding to the criticism and how the therapy is changing and evolving. Here's Liz.
ABA has become a touchy subject over the past few years, but not all experts have shied away from talking about it. One of them is clinical psychologist and assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Medical School, Melanie Palacia.
I do research and clinical work with young children with autism spectrum disorder and their families.
Melanie first came across ABA as a junior in college. One of her psych professors at the time had an ABA therapy company. So Melanie started working there part-time as a therapist for autistic kids. These were kids with really intense challenges. Kids who, in some cases, couldn't communicate, couldn't follow directions, couldn't even get through the day without screaming, violent meltdowns, or self-injurious behavior. So Melanie was pretty amazed when she saw how quickly ABA started making a difference.
It did feel like magic. It felt like I was helping kids do something that other people couldn't do.
Melanie could see why parents wanted this so much for their children and why ABA was considered the gold standard of treatment for kids with autism. So she ended up getting her master's in applied behavioral analysis and then her PhD in psychology, all so she could bring techniques like ABA to more kids who needed help. It wasn't until around 5 years ago that Melanie first remembers reading criticisms of ABA on social media. Comments that called ABA abuse, even torture, that said it had given them PTSD, that called it conversion therapy for autistic people, that said all it does is teach them to mask pain so they don't bother their neurotypical peers. By that time, Melanie had spent years delivering ABA, and she was distraught by what she was reading.
I think just the idea of it being abusive certainly is something that hit me in the gut. I think going into this field to help children and families and then seeing those kinds of treatments that we used and that we know helped lots of children and families be described as abusive certainly, I think, was hard to hear.
So Melanie sat with those critiques. And a few years ago, she gave a talk at a conference that was called Is ABA Passé? In it, she describes thinking back to this one patient she had, who she calls Davey, how she remembers seeing him crying when she'd pull up to their house, and it not bothering her at the time. Kids don't always like what's good for them, she thought, like going to school or eating their vegetables.
And so that was sort of the way that we were trained to think about those things is that it's okay if he's upset because he's learning and it's for his benefit. And we had a ton of data that showed that he was making progress. Him and all of the other kids that we were working with were learning really important skills that were improving their daily lives.
Now, Melanie wondered, were those gains worth making kids miserable, even traumatized? Was there a way to do ABA that didn't feel like eating vegetables? That's when Melanie remembered this ABA workshop she'd gone to around 15 years earlier, where the trainer said something that, thinking back, flipped a switch in Melanie's brain about what ABA should look like.
The child should view you as a giant chocolate chip cookie. They want more of that cookie. They want more opportunities for engagement.
It's an idea that's spread among ABA practitioners in the years since. And according to Melanie, along with a handful of other clinicians I talked to, that is what a lot of ABA looks like today. or what it should look like anyway.
It should look like fun and play. If it's implemented in a developmentally appropriate method, it looks like an instructor playing with a child with things that that child likes.
So not a strict, highly structured system of rewards and punishments designed to reinforce specific behaviors, but like any other preschool classroom, songs and messy art projects, all through intensive engagement with a therapist. It's a big shift, one that the experts I talk to say has to do both with developments in the science of ABA and with the critiques of outspoken activists. But even with that kinder, gentler version of ABA, there's still a big question that remains. What should the goal of ABA be? What is the desired outcome, and who gets to decide? I talked to Wendy Ross, a developmental and behavioral pediatrician who runs the Jefferson Center for Autism and Neurodiversity. And she says there's been a major cultural shift in how we think about autism.
There used to be a group called Cure Autism Now. And I think even Autism Speaks used to have this bent about, like, we're going to fix this. And I think now the culture is really much different, right? It's more about acceptance. Like, it used to be Autism Awareness Day. Now it's more like Autism Acceptance Day. It's not about erasing autism. It's about understanding neurodiversity and how, you know, everyone sort of belongs.
Take, for example, the whole eye contact thing.
Why is making eye contact better? Isn't that sort of making a cultural choice, right?
How does it help somebody with autism on a practical level to be forced to make eye contact? Is it for them, or is it for the comfort of the neurotypical people around them? This whole idea that autism isn't some disease that needs to be treated, but just a way that some people are, has started making its way into ABA. For one thing, the goals of ABA are different now. Instead of using the same checklist of behavioral changes for each kid, the goals are now chosen together with the kid and their parents, tailored to their specific needs.
There's a much better understanding that the needs and development of children today is heterogeneous, right? So there's this saying that if you know one person with autism, you know one person.
Melanie Pelletia, the chocolate chip cookie psychologist, agreed with Wendy.
We should not be changing behavior just for the sake of changing behavior. We should be intervening on things that will have a meaningful impact on that individual's life. Things like communication and successful participation in their family and daily routines. What we should do is making sure that we are helping that child be as successful as possible in a way that is meaningful to them.
As for the original ABA goal of, quote, making autistic kids indistinguishable from their neurotypical peers.
So it certainly should not be a stated goal of ABA. And I think if that is a goal that anyone has, that would be a red flag.
One of the most important shifts, Wendy says, is how modern ABA thinks about behavior. Not as something that needs to be changed, but as a source of information.
You know, what I would call contemporary ABA is really understanding behavior.
Understanding, she says, that especially for kids who aren't able to speak, behavior is itself communication.
Thinking about what function is that behavior serving that child, and what do we need to do to help the child be more comfortable in the world. The perspective is really changing into how do we need to change the environment for this child so that they have a more fulfilling life experience.
To me, all of this sounded like a game changer. Like the ABA field had really heard and digested the criticism and was trying to do better. What I wanted to know was, how many practitioners have actually ditched the old ABA for the new? So I got in touch with David Mandel. He's the director at the Center for Mental Health at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Medicine. And he spent years doing research on how to improve quality of care for autistic people. So I asked him, have we made a widespread wholesale shift from old school ABA to the new, more play-like, kid-centered ABA?
No, and it has nothing to do with ABA per se. It has to do with the fact that we suck at making large-scale change in community practice, right? And we publish these papers and we develop these programs and we do these randomized trials and we put them in academic journals and we expect that that's going to result in widespread community change. And it doesn't. It never has.
That's partly just because it's hard on a practical level making big changes happen. But one of the other big problems, David says, is ABA's PR problem.
And that's that one of the big challenges we have with ABA, right, is the name itself has become so stigmatizing and so polarizing. We've in some ways come to an impasse because of ABA's deservedly poor early reputation.
David says ABA needs to renounce that history, especially their early reliance on punishments like yelling, hitting, and most controversially, electroshocks, which are still used in at least one notorious institution today. So I asked David, how would that change happen?
So I think a big part of it is those researchers and clinicians acknowledging the failures of the field to date, right? So I think there has to be some public reckoning around those issues.
In other words, an apology. The second thing David says is researchers and clinicians need to partner with stakeholders in the autism community, or as David likes to call them, shareholders.
These are people who all have a share, not just a stake, but a share in the decision-making process. And so I think partnering with those folks to talk about what are the goals we should be working towards and what are acceptable strategies to do that? How do we address what is disabling about autism and not just what makes autistic people different than other people and target our interventions that way? And how do we do it in a way that is led by the autistic person themselves?
Third, David says we need to make sure ABA actually works using large-scale randomized trials and to decide what it means for ABA to work. Finally, the step that so far keeps getting forgotten, we need to look at potential harms. Some of those changes have already started, but that doesn't mean it'll be easy to convert hearts and minds. There's still a lot of doubt among autistic self-advocates that ABA is capable of changing. Maybe they say it's just rotten from the inside out. And given other therapeutic alternatives, maybe ABA should just be scrapped altogether.
That's Liz Tung. We're listening to her in-depth reporting on applied behavior analysis, ABA. It's a therapy for autism that's been very popular and standard for about the last 20 years, but is now facing a lot of pushback. So some say it should be abandoned, but coming up, we'll hear a different perspective.
People with profound autism need ABA. And just because you are diagnosed with autism and are high functioning enough to speak doesn't mean you should speak for everyone.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're exploring a go-to therapy approach for autism called ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis. ABA has a lot of fierce critics these days who say it's not effective, but beyond that, it's punitive and harmful. Liz Tung has been reporting on this, and after speaking to people who told her about bad experiences with ABA and others who work in the field and acknowledge that ABA needs to change, she was left wondering, should this approach just be scrapped altogether? But then Liz talked to a therapist who uses ABA. The therapist's name is Jennifer King. She is a behavior analyst and feeding specialist. And the conversation offered a different perspective. Here's Liz again.
It's common, Jennifer told me, for autistic kids and adults to have extremely limited and sometimes unhealthy diets. Maybe they only like pureed foods or crunchy foods like pretzels or chips.
They may also engage in severe food refusal. So when the parent tries to introduce something new, like a fruit or a vegetable, something that's healthier for them, they may engage in aggression, self-injury, and then their diet becomes more and more restricted.
Jennifer says these kinds of problems can get really serious. We're talking kids with anemia or scurvy, kids who are obese or have limited growth, even kids who've had to be put on feeding tubes. That's where Jennifer comes in. She uses an ABA-based approach to train her patients, who are mostly kids, to expand their diets. In cases like these, she says ABA can literally be life-saving. Mostly, Jennifer uses rewards. For example, when a kid takes a tiny bite of food, they get rewarded with a few minutes of their favorite TV show.
I can pause a video and wait for them to take a bite, so that's called a response cost, and that's used to decrease food refusal.
Sometimes she also uses praise or light reprimands as reinforcement. It might sound pretty mild, but Jennifer says she's had serious disagreements with colleagues about whether or not ABA is appropriate, especially when it comes to essentially forcing a kid to eat something they don't want to eat.
I have a friend who's a dietitian, and for years we were at odds. We would have the same conversation where she would say, "You should never use reinforcers for eating food." And I said, "But why not? If you have a child who's on a feeding tube, if you have a child who is eating three foods and they're malnourished, or they don't know how to chew, why can't you use rewards?" And this light bulb went off for her, and she said, "You know, this whole time I've been assuming we're working with the same types of kids, and we're not. You're working with kids who may not even be eating by mouth, so you're not starting at the same baseline level."
This led me to a bigger question. Is it acceptable? Is it worth it to put a kid through something they hate, something they might later feel violated their autonomy, maybe even traumatize them, if the stakes are this high? If you're helping a kid who's unable to speak, communicate for the first time, or you're helping a kid who's on a feeding tube be able to eat for themselves. I asked Jennifer what her response was to people who criticize ABA.
Those people who are able to advocate and who are able to criticize ABA obviously have very good language skills. And they may be able to have a job. They may be able to take care of themselves socioeconomically. They may have had access to more therapy.
And she says that's very different from a kid who has a much more serious form of autism.
Who can't talk, who's engaging in severe self-injurious behavior, who may be causing tissue damage, who may have lost their eyesight because of head banging or eye gouging. So those children may never be able to step up and say, "Yeah, I wish someone hadn't done ABA with me. I don't think that was ethical. Someone should have accepted me for who I am." I don't think it's okay to say we shouldn't use ABA to help those individuals. And for some of these children, ABA is life-saving.
So it's a balance, weighing the good against the bad. The problem, as Jennifer pointed out, is that a lot of the autistic people who stand to benefit the most from ABA are the ones who literally aren't able to speak up about their experiences. And she worries that their needs are being ignored in the battle over ABA. But some of their parents are speaking up, including Allison Singer, the woman we heard from earlier, whose brother and daughter Jody both have profound autism. Allison echoed a lot of what Jennifer said.
I think the criticism of ABA comes from very high-functioning autistic adults. And my feeling is that if you are high-functioning enough, if your IQ is high enough and your verbal skills are strong enough for you to articulate a nuanced criticism of the philosophy of ABA and the methodology behind ABA, then you don't really need ABA.
The problem, Allison says, is that the term autism spectrum disorder has gotten hugely broad. Today, being autistic can mean graduating at the top of your law school class or, like Allison's daughter, living with profound intellectual disabilities.
People with profound autism need ABA. And just because you are diagnosed with autism and are high functioning enough to speak doesn't mean you should speak for everyone.
Allison told me that her daughter, Jody, is minimally verbal, so she may not be able to express what she thinks of ABA. But Allison says when she looks at her brother's life and at Jody's, there's a huge difference, one that she credits to ABA.
You know, prior to ABA, she had these terrible tantrums because she wasn't able to express her needs. I wasn't able to understand what it was that she was trying to tell me. And that changed with ABA. And her life is dramatically improved. She's able to be part of the community.
Today, Jody's 25 and still profoundly autistic, Allison says. And she lives a good life.
She lives and works at the Center for Discovery, which is an intentional community for individuals with a wide range of disabilities in the Catskills in New York. And she's thriving there. She has a job, one that she loves.
It's a farm, and Jody gets to do something she's always loved, working with animals, raising sheep and chickens, and then selling what the farm produces to the local community.
And she's very, very engaged and really thriving. So, you know, even though she is profoundly affected by her autism, she's still able to work and be a contributing member of society.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We've been hearing all about applied behavior analysis, which is a popular therapy for kids with autism. In Liz's reporting, we heard that the quality of therapy that people receive can vary a lot, and that sometimes the amount of therapy can feel excessive. A new investigative report from Stat News might shed some light on the reasons for that. Tara Bano covers the business side of healthcare for Stat. She says starting about a decade ago, when states were making it mandatory for insurance to cover the therapy, private equity firms started buying up practices. One of the biggest complaints she heard from parents and therapists was that kids were not getting the kind of individualized treatment that ABA was known for.
What I'm told is that with private equity-owned practices, it's very common to use these, you know, cookie-cutter templates. It's like, are you 20 hours a week? Are you 40 hours a week? And it really causes people to miss out on the quality associated with a personalized therapy. And they get more of, like, it was described to me often as a McDonald's of therapy. Another big complaint is that, you know, parents felt like they were just being kind of hounded to accept more and more hours of therapy than they can handle, like upwards of 40 hours a week. And these are really young kids, like 5 years old. And so sometimes they're in school. Oftentimes they're getting occupational therapy, speech therapy. So it's a big stressor for the child and the family. It's also stressful for the therapist. So they're actually being encouraged to kind of hound the parents to take on more hours. It was sort of described to me like they're credit card debt collectors.
Another issue that bubbled up was how private equity firms were billing for their services.
There's a lot of overbilling in ABA, tons of just ways that these companies seem to be gaming the system. Like there was one clinician in Nevada who was found to have billed for 65 hours in a single day. And this is one single person, not a company. And then Nevada also did an audit of 4 years, and they found 1,000 providers in those 4 years who billed for delivering 24 hours of therapy in a single day. That's one person delivering 24 hours of therapy in a single day. Now, obviously, it's impossible. There's a lot of this happening in Florida. Florida alone actually barred 645 ABA providers in 2019 from accepting Medicaid because of suspected fraud.
A federal agency is now conducting a broad audit of Medicaid claims for ABA. That report is expected by the end of the year.
There just seems to be this pattern of billing issues across multiple states and at the federal level. And the federal government, I think, has finally just said, look, we're going to take a really sweeping look at this and figure out what's going on.
Tara Bano covers hospitals, providers, and insurers for Stat News. We'll post a link to her report on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.